Joe Biden tries to pass the increasingly less valuable buck on inflation, protests at the homes of Supreme Court justices, and is Rick Scott the ultra mega target Democrats have been waiting for? We'll discuss all this and more on this edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lowry. I'm joined as always by the Right Honorable Charles C.W. Cook, Alexander Zan de Sanctis, and the notorious M.B.D. Michael Brendan Doherty. You are, of course, listening to a National Review podcast. Our sponsors this episode are Allegiance Gold, Moink, and ExpressVPN. More about all of them in due course. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service out there, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And please give this podcast, if you enjoy what you hear here, the glowing five-star reviews it deserves. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget said anything. So before we start in earnest, let me do a quick pitch for Allegiance Gold, the official gold IRA of the Editors podcast. Inflation rates, we'll talk about them more in a minute, are a growing concern for Americans with their retirement accounts. Allegiance Gold can help you protect your IRA 401k with physical gold and silver. They'll also give you $500 of free silver with a qualified purchase. That's $500 of free silver. Call 844-790-9191, 844-790-9191, or visit allegiancegold.com/editors. So MBD, Joe Biden gave a speech yesterday where that indicated, you know, they realize how big a problem inflation is. He says this is a number one priority of his administration. He said he is so in touch with the discontent of Americans and how they're suffering under higher prices that he can literally taste it, but then offered no new ideas to address the problem and proceeded to do all sorts of unconvincing blame shifting, whether it was to Vladimir Putin's. Obviously, the invasion of Ukraine has created yet more upward pressure on oil and gas prices, but that was already happening prior to the invasion. And then unconvincingly blaming, you know, the Trump tax cut for a bad fiscal picture, and on and on and on. What do you make of it?
It looked desperate, to be honest. They know this issue is killing them. And I do have some sympathy with Biden's case that he made early in the speech that the cause is two things are at work that aren't necessarily his fault, which are the pandemic and the policies that were chosen even before he was president to deal with it, and the war in Ukraine. Those are seriously inflationary, and his Congress's first policy did make it worse, and many of his other plans would too, but some of this was already, you know, baked into the cake. I couldn't believe how weak he sounded in a way, right? Like at one point he said, here's how we would tackle inflation. My plan is to lower everyday costs for hardworking families and lower the deficit by asking large corporations and the wealthiest Americans to not engage in price gouging and to pay their fair share in taxes. I mean, that is not a plan for dealing with inflation. There is no evidence of anyone price gouging. You can't just lower everyday costs by asking people to stop price gouging. Paying their fair share in taxes, that's a matter of IRS enforcement. And there's no evidence that there's some huge, easy to obtain windfall for the government. And even if there were, that wouldn't have any effect on inflation. He's in a lot of trouble now too, because you still have inflation of everyday goods that Americans need, and even shortages, particularly this government-created shortage of baby formula, which is a separate issue. At the same time that you're seeing really ominous signs in the stock market of deflating equity prices, which signal maybe a recession to come and potentially future job losses. I'd be really worried if I was in holder of big tech stocks, as what you're seeing in crypto. I don't. It just looks like it looks like an unfolding disaster for Biden, and one that he's not equipped to cope with. I mean, he doesn't have really any more tools to do with it. It is up to the Fed. The Fed has the big power here, and the economy is already freaking out that it's starting to use it in even the most modest ways possible to contain inflation.
Yeah, so Zan, they just can't be honest about the diagnosis. Obviously, part of it is the supply chain disruptions, a big part of it, and the international turmoil. But another element of this that he just, if he had his way, he would add to, you know, as we speak, is that you had disruptions in the supply in our economy, and then you had government massively stoking demand. And a lot of that happened before Biden was inaugurated, but he threw another couple logs on the fire when it was clear that the economy was recovering and it didn't need another $2 trillion of so-called COVID relief. But when you have reduced demand, you know, because of the pandemic and also because of an administration that is pursuing an anti-business, sort of anti-supply policy, especially with regard to oil and gas, you reduce supply and then you stoke up demand, and you get high demand and relatively low supply. Just economics 101 is you're going to have higher prices. And so it is.
Yeah, I think the problem for the Biden administration right now, as it has been for a while, is that there's actually no truthful way, let alone, or no convincing way, let alone truthful way of explaining away their fault in the inflation situation right now. And that's why they turn to just utterly absurd things like, oh, this is the fault of Russia, when we all know this was happening long before the Russia-Ukraine conflict started. So it's just nonsense. And his, you know, attempted solutions are not real solutions at all. The second problem for him is that there actually isn't a way for him to, you know, impose further government control to work his way out of this one. So he's just reduced to, you know, stating things like Michael said, things that are not actually going to fix anything, things that are not, you know, actually not him changing policy at all. They're just asking people to do things differently, which isn't going to change anything. And so I think they're just kind of reduced to pointing the finger at other people, including Republicans, which is utterly absurd.
So Charlie, what do you think of the Putin's price hike and all the other associated blame shifting?
Well, I think it's the product of Joe Biden wishing that this were not the core issue of his presidency. And if you look back to the last time the United States suffered through serious inflation 40 years ago, the president who ended up having to deal with it wanted the job. He ran against Jimmy Carter, who, for what it's worth, did not deny inflation existed, saying that the great crisis of our time was inflation and that it needed to be beaten in order to restore America to its potential and ensure that the American dream survived. And Reagan wanted to be president during a period of inflation because he wanted to take it on. He had ideas about how to take it on. And his argument was, elect me and I'll fix it. And it will be horrible. And it was horrible. And he suffered in popularity greatly in 1981, too. Took losses in the midterms and then benefited after that from the return to normality. Now, contrast that with Biden. Yes, the circumstances are a little bit different in that it wasn't as clear in 2020 as in 1980 where this was headed. But Biden has not said inflation is a key problem and we're going to focus all our efforts on beating it. Quite the opposite. He said it's not happening. Then his party on a party line vote spent $2 trillion they were warned would make it worse. And he said, that's not going to make it worse. In fact, it will make it better. Then they spent the entire summer trying to spend another two, three, four, six of your Bernie Sanders $1 trillion. And Joe Biden flitted between, it's not happening, it's transitory. And if we spend $6 trillion, it will help. finally it's become undeniable. And he still wishes it weren't there. So he ends up saying, it's Republicans' fault they don't have a plan. Or it's Vladimir Putin's fault. Or if anything, our spending helped, which no one believes, by the way. No one. There may be some debate over the scope of the blame that the so-called American Rescue Plan has for our current predicament. But no one believes it made it better. And I think people don't believe him. And so what you're seeing from him is this begrudging recognition that this is hurting him, interspersed with attempts to either hand wave it away or move on to other things. And in that speech, it was clear that he hasn't recognized yet that he can't move on to other things. This isn't, well, six of one, half a dozen of the other, I guess we'll take this agenda item. No, this is his presidency. This is the problem. This is America right now. There is nothing else. There's not even Roe v. Wade. If you look at the weight that voters put on issues in opinion polls, even now, it's inflation. And it's just not enough to mess around at the edges with the strategic petroleum reserve. The
tax credits for clean energy. You know, like
none of that. You have to talk about it constantly and recognize. And I think that Joe Biden thinks that by saying, you know, when I was a kid and rough and tumble Pennsylvania, my dad would sit at the end of my bed and say, Joey, inflation hurts the working man, and all that nonsense he does. I think he thinks that's enough. I think he thinks that positioning and emoting is enough. Now, positioning and emoting can be important in politics. I wish it were less so, but it is. Bill Clinton grasped that intuitively. But you have to do more than just say, I feel your pain. You have to say, and here's what we're doing. And that's not what Biden did. He doesn't have a plan. He sounds defensive. He has broken the vow he made over and over again on the Florida radio 2020 that he won't blame anyone else for his misfortunes. And I think that's why people aren't responding.
Yeah, another important thing, and we just haven't seen this on anything, except for maybe arguably at the margins on crime, is you just need to go outside your comfort zone on some things. You know, say you're going to have a regulatory holiday, or say, go to oil field, you know, the Bakken, and say, look, we need to pump all we can, you know, and I'm urging everyone to do it, and everything government can do at the margins, we're going to do. But that's just hasn't characterized this administration on any single important issue. So MBD, exit question to you. If your guess at this juncture, if Joe Biden is a one-term president, let's just assume that for the sake of this question, his legacy will be better than Jimmy Carter's, the same as Jimmy Carter's, or worse than Jimmy Carter's?
If I'm betting now, I'm going to bet the same as Jimmy Carter's. The same. Yeah, because I think he's going to leave us not only with inflation, but with a festering foreign policy crisis that needs to be resolved. So, yeah, at least the same.
So we have a judicious same from MBD, Zan.
Yeah, I like this question a lot because I've been reading this book for a while about the 1980 presidential election, and I just keep thinking how similar that time period seems to right now. I mean, I obviously wasn't alive then, but I was, you know.
Yeah, I was hesitating to ask this question. I feared you would know nothing. Like Jimmy Carter, like that.
No, know, I do.
Like,
I
for
know.
You, that's like talking about Ulysses S. Grant. For
me. Yeah, I don't have memory of it, but I do. I feel like I've learned a lot about it through this book. And I keep thinking about how similar that time kind of feels through the history in the book to right now. But I think Biden will have a worse legacy. I don't wow. think what's happening in Russia and Ukraine is maybe as visceral for people as what was happening under Carter, but I do think that he just comes across way worse than Carter did because he seems to be somewhat losing it, and I think people can tell.
Charlie Cook, we got a same and a worse.
I think it's difficult, this, because first off, it's a little early.
Yeah.
It is early. It's okay.
Second.
Yeah, so change the question to Millard Fillmore.
No, but second, it's a different country in the sense that, you know, back in, I suppose the equivalent would have been 1978, the voting population of the United States was willing to throw its support behind someone else to the tune of 44 states. And that's not going to happen. Even if Biden is one of the worst presidents in history, it's just not going to happen. There's no way the next Republican candidate is going to win 44 states. So it's quite difficult to evaluate. But I think, from my own subjective position, I think Biden is at risk of being regarded as negatively as Carter. And it would only take a few more mistakes and misfortunes to get there. I the reason I hesitate is that there is a possibility that the Fed takes more aggressive action, the Republicans taking the House and possibly the Senate blocks any further damage that can be done, and the economy recovers in 2023 or early 2024, and Biden's standing improves. But I would say on balance, I think he's going to end up in the same breath.
Yeah, he could end up in the same league. I'm going to say at this juncture, better. To make it the same or worse, you know, the inflation needs to keep running out of control, which I kind of don't think it will, or there has to be a recession, which on top of this, which is plausible. Then there's the international arena where you'd need Russia somehow to kind of turn around what's happening in Ukraine. I don't know, God forbid, and I don't think it's going to happen, nuke Lviv or something and kind of actually shake the foundations of NATO. Don't see it happening. China moving on Taiwan next 2.5 years, maybe. Kind of don't see it happening. And then another event that would be outside of Biden's control would be a health crisis, and then a health crisis they deal with dishonestly, which would be in the control of the White House. That would be really bad. So I'm going to say better, but in one respect, worse. I'm still in better territory. But Carter, despite all the failures and the double digit and the stagflation, the gas lines, the real sense that the West was in a complete decline, and the sense that the Soviet Union was on the march across the board, he was fairly reasonable on a lot of stuff towards the end, especially, and pointed the way towards policies that Reagan would take. The hostage crisis, obviously, another one. The policies that Reagan would take up and that would forge the great renaissance of the 80s. So substantively, Carter was not, in terms of right. policy, was not as bad as Biden has been, or as Biden's attempting to be. But I think Biden would still need a couple steps down to be the same or worse than Jimmy Carter. And on that optimistic note, Charlie Cook, let's go to you for even more positive content, which is hearing more about our friends at Moink.
Well, as our readers know, I am a big Moink fan. I can't remember when I first got Moink, maybe a year and a half ago. But whenever it was, we have not missed a single month of Moink deliveries. And it actually somewhat spoils you when you're used to Moink, because their meat is just so much better. Moink, for those who don't know, is a monthly delivery service, and they will send straight to your home grass-fed and grass-finished beef and lamb, pastured pork and chicken, and sustainable wild-caught Alaskan salmon. Moink farmers farm like our grandparents did, and as a result, Moink meat tastes like it should, because the family farm does it better. The Moink difference is a difference you can taste, and you can feel good knowing you're helping family farms stay financially independent too. You choose the meat delivered in every box, like ribeyes, chicken breast, pork chop, salmon fillets, and much more. And you can cancel any time, although you won't want to. Shark Tank host Kevin O'Leary called Moink's bacon the best bacon he's ever tasted. And the founder of the Ring doorbell, Jamie Siminoff, jumped at the chance to invest in Moink. If you want to keep American farming going by signing up at moinkbox.com/editors right now, you will, as a listener of this show, get free filet mignon in every order for a year. That's 1 year of the best filet mignon you'll ever taste. But this offer is for a limited time only, so sign up quickly. That's spelt Moink, M-O-I-N-K, box.com/editors. That's moinkbox.com/editors.
Thanks so much, Charlie. Please check out Moink. We all love it. So, Zan, what we don't love is these protests we saw over the weekend, and I believe yesterday as well, in front of the homes of Justices Roberts, Kavanaugh, and Alito. The night of the Supreme Court leak, if I remember correctly, Andy McCarthy, when we talked briefly on the phone or texting, I forget which, he's like, they're going to target their homes. That's what this is about. And it immediately went there with the doxing of their homes and this cretinous outfit saying we're sending protesters there. And these are people literally trying to intimidate the highest court in the land that is deliberating on this really important constitutional question, trying to decide a legal case. They are trying to use a form of coercion to change the votes. It's just shocking. It's a really disturbing statement about where this country is at the moment and is fundamentally un-American.
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's unbelievable, but frankly, I just am not even all that surprised by it. And I think, you know, we haven't gotten any confirmation about who perpetrated this leak, but I think what we've witnessed from all the coordination afterwards from pro-abortion folks suggests to me, or kind of confirms my hunch, I would say, that this came from someone within the court who, you know, fears that the draft majority opinion that was leaked will be the final majority opinion, and kind of wanted to give the pro-abortion forces their chance to change the outcome, or at least to undermine the court in the process. And it's a really frightening development, obviously, for the safety of the justices, but also just for the court in general, for our country. And it's not surprising to me at all that this came up when it came to abortion, right? Because this case has, for 50 years now, Roe v. Wade has essentially mandated abortion on demand throughout the entire country. The American people have not been able to have their will put into law on this matter, you know, whether it's their very pro-abortion policies or their they can have their pro-abortion policies, but not because of their votes, right? They're having, the court has mandated this for everybody, regardless of people's views. It's been taken out of the democratic process. And rather than saying, okay, you know, maybe this decision will be gone, but now we'll turn our attention to the legislatures or, you know, my home state where I can, you know, try to lobby and get the pro-abortion policies I want, these people are going to try and intimidate the Supreme Court into putting not public opinion, but their specific, you know, extreme pro-abortion opinion, keeping it as a Supreme Court mandate. And that is just unacceptable, but that's how they think about abortion. They're afraid of the democratic process. They know that if it comes to that, only a handful of states are going to have their preferred abortion policy. And they want it to stay in place as this totally illegitimate, anti-constitutional decision, because then states won't be able to protect unborn children. And that's really what they're after. I don't think they will stop at anything, I'm afraid, to get that.
So, Charlie, this is illegal under federal law. You're not supposed to be able to protest outside the home of a judge, juror, witness, or court officer, because obviously that is potentially distortive of a legal process. And again, we've all sort of slid, not you, but a lot of people slid into the idea that the court makes political decisions. So I don't think anyone should ever protest outside the home of anyone, even if they're elected official. But, you know, you show up at the town halls of elected officials and ask pointed questions, and you might hold protests, you know, outside their office or where they're where they're located, just to indicate how strongly you feel about something. But importing that into the judicial realm is really disturbing, as I said a minute ago, and these protests are technically illegal.
Yeah, so when I first read the law to which you're referring, my contrarian instincts kicked in, and I thought, I don't know. You know, there are very few laws restricting speech or protest that I like or believe to be consistent with the First Amendment. But then I read it again, and I think there's a strong case for it. And it reminds me of the case that is made, for example, in favor of certain time and place restrictions on the carrying of arms. If you go back to the early Republic, prior to the Constitution, but after the Revolution, some states passed laws, or in some cases, constitutional provisions that limited the right to keep and bear arms at polling places. The purpose of those laws was to ensure that nobody casting their vote felt intimidated. I think that makes sense. And I've argued in favor of similar provisions, often against other conservatives, to the modern day. For example, when the president shows up at CPAC, the Secret Service blocked the whole area off. And if you're carrying a firearm legally, you can't. You have to go through a metal detector. Similarly, political conventions, such as the Republican convention of 2016, blocked off firearms. People said, oh, it's so hypocritical. Well, it's not. It's not. I mean, if there are people on the floor who are casting votes, then there are defensible reasons to limit the amendment's scope. And I think you can make a similar case here. Alexandra is absolutely correct when she says that the consequence of an overturning of Roe will be to return this question to the democratic process. The decision itself should not be and cannot be subject to any democratic processes whatsoever. This is a legal question. It's not a political question. The Supreme Court has been charged with interpreting the Constitution. The Constitution's meaning doesn't change. It is not particularly interesting what this mob or that mob or this legislator or that legislator or this majority or that majority of voters wants. The Constitution's meaning is fixed. If those people want to change that meaning, then they can band together and pass a constitutional amendment. As such, there is no such thing as legitimate political pressure on the judicial branch, whether that's at a trial for an individual or whether that's in a constitutional context. And I think this law almost certainly passes constitutional muster and should, because clearly the intention here is to interfere with the judicial process. Now, we would understand instinctively why that is a bad idea if this were a murder trial. You know, if we had mobs showing up outside of the homes of jurors or the judge in a high-profile murder trial, we would consider that offensive to the impartial exercise of law. And I think we should hear as well, just because this issue will be returned to the democratic process and should always have been democratic in nature, does not mean that this decision should be subject to those pressures. So on second considerations, I think if you can justify a certain time and place restrictions for the Second Amendment based on the potential for intimidation, I think you could do the same thing with judicial offices, and the law doesn't solely apply to the Supreme Court, and that it would probably pass muster irrespective of that. Even if I'm wrong on that, and you know, please, if you're a lawyer and you disagree with me, send me emails explaining why. I think as a matter of civic hygiene and political and social norms, this should be discouraged in the strongest terms. I was pleased to see this morning that Dick Durbin did just that. I wish the president could do it. I wish Jen Psaki could do it, and they haven't done so. They have waffled on this. I think everyone here, irrespective of their view on this case, should be horrified by this development and should understand that if this does become a common occurrence. It will not be limited to this issue or one set of judges, but it will affect our culture far more broadly than that. So legal or not, don't do it.
Yeah, so MBD, as Charlie points out, to their credit, there have been a couple Democrats who have strongly pushed back against this. The White House, at best, has been mealy-mouthed, which is just a fundamental dereliction of its duty. And the Senate, to its credit, passed quite handily the enhanced protection for Supreme Court justices. But where are we that Supreme Court justices need enhanced security? And you just don't want to go down this road. Now, hopefully, you know, they've done these couple protests. That's it. There's nothing like this. There's no attempt, God forbid, to harm someone. But the problem with this is it invites retaliation, right? And it invites the other side to pick this up. It's like, okay, you're intimidating folks that might be on our side on a really important issue. We're gonna do exactly the same thing. And then you can see a spiral downward that really erodes our institutions and sort of free, independent, well-reasoned deliberation, because intimidation is the opposite of that.
Right, and it also, it transgresses a kind of fundamental Republican norm, which is that the person is not the office, right? I mean, the it's a royalist norm to look at a political person and see the state in them at all times, right? That's how you look at a king, right? We just had the Queen's speech this week. In a republic, we don't do that. Justice Alito, when he goes home, is no longer Justice Alito. He is a father, he's a neighbor, he's a spouse, maybe he's a member of some other civic organizations. And to bring the intimidation there is to, or to bring protest there at all, is to miscast our protest. It's to bring it where it does not belong at all. Because those roles, whatever you think of his leaked ruling, even if you think it is a transgression of human rights, to bring that the protest there is to poison Republican norms. It's to refuse to recognize that in his home he is playing other pro-social roles that are good for the community. So I think it's very dangerous. And, you know, a couple people pointed out, I mentioned this on the corner, a couple of people pointed out that, oh, there have been protests at Chuck Schumer's home in New York, which is true, and which I also think should not be done. The reason this is getting more attention than Chuck Schumer's is because, one, legally it's different when it's a judge in a, you know, that is a legal distinction that matters. But two, it's because it's a single family home that is just inherently more vulnerable than an apartment building with 24/7 security and a doorman, right? Like, it's not like the protesters were 10 feet away from Chuck Schumer's, the door of his actual residence, which would be much more frightening. So anyway, I think it's something that Jen Psaki has to find her voice on. And I've been happy to see others. I want to give credit to New York Times columnist Michelle Goldberg, who was very good on this matter and noted that some of the rules about protesting in residential areas actually came about because pro-lifers were protesting at the homes of abortion clinic doctors. So she said that this is a norm that we should keep going, no matter who's violating it or transgressing it.
So, Zan, another element of the post-leak debate has been your old friend, Kate Smith, who once was a CBS reporter, at least supposedly, that's what she was, an abortion access reporter at CBS. You were highly critical of her work, and I believe predicted 2 years ago that she'd eventually go work for Planned Parenthood. Sure enough, she is now working for Planned Parenthood. She had an interview with Brian Stelter a couple days ago, and he brought up your criticism of her work, and she said, among other things, that you, Zan, just don't know how newsrooms work. There's so many layers of fact-checking and lawyering that went into everything she was doing at CBS. If you just knew more about journalism, you would have realized that her work was completely sound and objective.
I have to admit, it was pretty gratifying to actually hear Kate Smith respond to my piece, because I wrote this about 2 years ago. And, I just kind of came up with this phrase, Planned Parenthood's ambassador to CBS, because I went through all her work when I wrote this piece, and I realized she essentially just, you know, repeats Planned Parenthood, NARAL, Center for Reproductive Rights talking points as if they're facts in her own voice, and just states these things, you know, uses terms like reproductive rights, abortion access, these kind of buzzwords of the abortion advocacy movement as if they were, you know, neutral facts from a reporter. And she billed herself very much as a neutral reporter. And yet, you know, she'd get these scoops, like the first interview with the new president of Planned Parenthood, and they would ask questions like, you know, if we want to support, there are a lot of groups we could support that help low-income women access healthcare. Why Planned Parenthood? You know, these absolute PR softball type questions. So it was very obvious that she had an angle and that it was influencing the way she did this supposed reporting. And so, you know, the fact that she's now officially working for Planned Parenthood is no surprise, but she really was working for Planned Parenthood all along, and perhaps was even more influential in their favor as a CBS reporter, honestly, because I think she could kind of disguise their talking points as if they were reported facts. But it was hilarious to hear her in this interview just say, oh, you know, a blogger online doesn't know how newsrooms work, and we have our lawyers vet everything, to which I'd say, if lawyers were really vetting that and it's all fact-checked, that makes it far more problematic.
So Charlie Cook, exit question to you. Who at the moment do you believe is winning the debate about the perspective? We don't know where they're actually going to get there. The perspective post-Roe future, pro-lifers, pro-choicers, neither.
Neither. I think it's a wash. I think in one sense, that's a victory for the pro-lifers, because it will facilitate the return of this issue to the democratic process. But it also reminds us that pro-lifers have a lot of work to do. So I think it's 50-50. I also think, and perhaps I'm horribly wrong about this, people care less about this than the press thinks they do.
Mm-hmm. MBD.
I tend to agree with Charlie. I think... I think we've fooled ourselves that we understand abortion politics in this country, because we've been discussing it for 50 years.
Yeah, it's like on the verge of starting now.
But yeah, exactly. It's like we haven't actually begun to talk about it in a firm and real way as a democratic people. And that's why the debate has been, you know, philosophical and legal rather than political. I think Charlie's right. Neither.
Zan.
Yeah, I think it's probably closest to neither, but I do think that that this kind of protesting outside the homes of Supreme Court justices, it has to be abhorrent to most people, even if they, you know, tend to support abortion, at least in some circumstances. And just the way that this all has gone, I think kind of affirms the reality that this needs to be put back into the democratic process. And I think that in itself is a win for pro-lifers.
But by the way, can I just say that there's like this funny twist on this issue, in that you have, you know, candidates for office saying, like, you know, we have to trust people to make their own personal healthcare decisions, like 6 months after supporting mandates on vaccines that, you know, don't allow for trust in individuals to make their own healthcare decisions. I don't know. There's a kind of, there really is this oddness to the rhetoric. Like, I know a lot of people who've joined groups for medical free choice in the last year that have nothing to do with abortion politics. So there's something really scrambled about American politics on medicine and free choice right now that makes things interesting.
So I'm also inconclusive. I think it's the right answer. Zan is right. These protests are not going to be popular and are appalling to people to the extent they're paying attention. On the other hand, you know, Roe is superficially popular. So that works to the pro-choicers' benefit. And this is also, for Democrats generally, this is the best thing they got. I take Charlie's point that it is not going to be decisive, I believe, in the midterms or fundamentally change the dynamic, but it's more helpful to Democrats than anything else they got going, because they got nothing else going. But so I'm none of the above, but take MBD's point that was put very pungently in a tweet after this leak. You know, after 50 years as pro-lifers, we had to take, you know, half a century of effort just to get to the starting gate, to really start this debate and really try to protect these unborn lives in America. So Charlie Cook, let's go to you for yet another read. That Moink read was so compelling that you should do the ExpressVPN one as well.
I will, because I use ExpressVPN too. I don't order my Moink boxes through it because I want the whole internet to know that I'm ordering Moink. But if I didn't want the whole internet to know that I was ordering Moink, the first thing I would do is switch on my VPN, specifically my ExpressVPN, which would help me disappear. Now, you may think that you can achieve the same thing by browsing in incognito mode, but you can't. It's not actually as incognito as you think. All it really does is stop tracking you inside the browser and clear your cookies when you close it. In fact, your browser is probably making its fortune by tracking your movements online. And what do big tech companies say when you point that out and call them out for collecting your user data? They say, well, don't worry, incognito does not mean invisible, and we never said that it did. So how do you actually make yourself as invisible as possible online? Use ExpressVPN as I do. Turns out that even in incognito mode, your online activity still gets tracked and data brokers still get to buy and sell your data. Now, one of those data points that they really care about is your IP address. Data harvesters use that IP address to uniquely identify you and your location and cross-reference it with what you're doing. With ExpressVPN, all of your communication, all of it, including the DNS, gets rerouted through an encrypted server somewhere else. You can choose where. And your IP address is completely masked. Every time you connect to ExpressVPN, you get a random IP address, which is shared by many other ExpressVPN customers. And that makes it harder for third parties to identify you, where you are, harvest your data, etc. And best of all, ExpressVPN really is super easy to use. No matter what device you're on, your phone, your laptop, even your smart TV, all you have to do is tap a single button for instant protection and forget you set it. So if you really want to go into incognito mode, you really want to protect your privacy, secure yourself with the number one rated VPN. Visit expressvpn.com/editors and get 3 extra months for free. That's expressvpn.com/editors. Go to expressvpn.com/editors to learn more.
Thanks so much, Charlie. So, Zan, another prong of Biden's statement the other day, and this is now a party-wide effort, is to run against the ultra-mega Republicans embodied by Florida Senator Rick Scott. Rick Scott introduced an agenda a couple of months ago. It's not a contract with America type thing. One, it's basically, it's only Rick Scott. Plus, it has, I think, a couple hundred possible initiatives thrown in there. It's more kind of like, let's think about these kind of document. I think that's useful, but there's some things in there that are easy targets. The most obvious is this skin in the game tax proposal that says, let's have everyone pay some federal income tax. I don't think that makes a lot of sense. And politically, just wanting to raise taxes in any form whatsoever on working class people is a bad idea. Democrats have fastened on it. And I don't think this makes a lot of sense. One, no one knows what ultra MAGA supposedly means. It's really insidery.
I think it's the new Marvel movie, right?
it's really insidery kind of phrase. No one knows who Rick Scott is. You're not going to make Rick Scott into a bogeyman. He was a successful two-term governor of Florida. He played to the center in Florida. He was a precursor of what we're seeing more widely now with Republicans making inroads with Latino voters because Rick Scott worked that so hard. And no one else is on this agenda. And then technically, you know, the things that Biden was hitting on, this tax plan, and then there's a proposal in there to reauthorize big entitlement programs like Social Security every 5 years. These aren't MAGA proposals, right? If you want to go ultra MAGA, you know, look at some of the things J.D. Vance, for instance, talked about, you know, seizing the wealth of left-wing nonprofits or whatever it is. If there's such a thing as ultra MAGA, that's it. None of this is. And this seems yet another desperation move.
Yeah, I think it's very telling that this is what they want to latch onto right now. I mean, the Democrats are just flailing in every possible quarter. The idea that they seem to think that Roe being overturned is going to somehow hand them the midterms or save them in the midterms. And now their best attack on Republicans is to pretend that the entire party is whatever, you know, the 99th point of Rick Scott's sort of brainstorming document has to say. I mean, it's crazy. And I don't think they're going to convince the average voter that this is a real thing. I don't think that the average voter cares or, like you said, knows what ultra MAGA even means. And I think it's very similar to what we've seen with the press for the last year, more than a year now, which is all they want to do is somehow make the conversation still about Donald Trump or whatever nefarious thing they can try and come up with that's, you know, Trumpy or Trump light or ultra Trump or ultra MAGA or whatever it is, because they want whatever the kind of political benefits to them were of having Trump around. They want to keep those. And as much as they hated him, they found him very useful as a foil because it was something to point to and avoid defending whatever nonsense it is they're, you know, perpetrating at any given moment and just say, look how bad Trump is. And so I think they want to have that still. And that's why they're coming up with these kind of silly lines that they think are going to evoke that specter in people's minds. And I really don't think it's going to work.
So MBD, I don't blame them from trying to make Trump an issue. Trump is obviously still hugely influential, partly or almost wholly, depending on how you look at it, owns the Republican Party. His endorsements aren't bulletproof, but they're hugely influential in Republican primaries. But you know, he's not on the ballot anywhere. He's not president of the United States at the moment. So this just seems very unlikely to succeed.
Yeah, I mean, it's an all-of-the-above approach for the Democrats. They have to try, and he's the last hate figure on the Republican side for them. I mean, and, you know, Republicans have done this too. They ran against Obama after Obama's presidency ended. So it's natural and normal. I think what's a little bit different this time is that what makes it a little bit more credible is that Donald Trump has made noises and hints that he could come back, right? And constitutionally, he's able to run for another term if he wants to, and everyone is treating him as a potential candidate. So I think it's just all fair for Democrats to do that. I just agree with you that it's not going to help.
So, Charlie, where do you come down on this question of whether Republicans should have an agenda or not? They've taken this tendency to an extreme. I mean, they didn't even have a platform in 2020. And Mitch McConnell, who, if nothing else, is a very canny player, is always against having any sort of positive proposals because his attitude is the other side's messing up. Why give them anything to shoot at? On the other hand, whatever you think of the Rick Scott attempt at this, it's one kind of respectful of voters to say, hey, this is what we want to do if we're going to take power. Two, it helps you once you've taken power to have the stuff on the shelf and have something of a mandate for it.
Well, I think there are two separate questions here. The first is, should the Republican Party as a general matter have an agenda? And the answer is yes. And it doesn't really. I have thought recently, well, what's going to happen if Republicans take Congress and then win the presidency? in 2024? And the answer is that they don't know. I leave aside the structural restraints, all of which I support, including when they hinder my own side, the filibuster, the structure of the Senate, the presidential veto. Republicans don't have a coherent approach. I mentioned 1980. In 1980, the Republican Party knew what it wanted to do. The president of the United States knew what he wanted to do. That isn't really the case now. And that needs to be fixed, because if you look at the Trump administration, there were many good political changes. The Supreme Court was probably the most important of them. I oppose the tax cuts on deficit grounds, but that was an achievement, irrespective of what you think of it. But the Republican Party didn't really have many ideas beyond that. And, you know, judges and tax cuts are perennial. But when it came to healthcare policy, it didn't have a repeal bill ready. And it turned out that it didn't have the votes, didn't do anything with entitlements, didn't fundamentally change the size or structure of the federal government, and so on and so forth. And eventually those things are going to need to be done. So yeah, it's a problem in general that the Republican Party doesn't really have a platform. Is it a problem that the Republican Party doesn't have a nailed down platform going into 2022? No, I don't think that it is. First off, the fact that it doesn't have a platform means that it can't have a platform, because it doesn't agree on what it wants to do. I don't like the fact that Rick Scott seems to have freelanced this. I think if you're going to have the sort of document that he has put together out there, then it should have extremely broad input and buy-in. It doesn't. And it's put him at odds with some of the party, with some of the party's messaging, and specifically with Mitch McConnell. Also, the Republican Party is not going to get anything done under a Biden presidency, even if it controls the Senate and the House. And as such, it should be content for now with blocking and overseeing what the executive branch does. And there's nothing wrong with that. I'm sure the second that Republicans take back the House, we will start hearing that word again, obstruction, obstruction, obstruction. But actually, obstruction is fine. Congress has the power in this country, or is supposed to, and blocking the agenda of the president is an entirely acceptable and worthwhile use of it. It is, if Republicans take back the House, going to be the case that the latest plebiscite was won by the GOP, in part because what the Democrats had done with their power was disliked. So I don't think there will be any particular issue if Republicans win in 2022 and say, you know what, we don't like what you've done with your power. We don't like what you passed legislatively. We don't like your budget. We don't like what you've done to the economy. We're now going to block that. But once it's done that, it is going to have to think long and hard about what it wants to do with power in the future. And it can't just wait until it finds out who its nominee is. Of course, it matters who the presidential nominee is, because he or she will have their own ideas and approach. They will represent a certain part of the party. They will have their own priorities and their own agenda. But again, Congress is where the action is supposed to be. And Republican Party exists in Congress independently of the executive branch and should have a broad vision for what it wishes to do with power. Because if it doesn't, 6, 7, 8 months will pass, if indeed it gets a trifecta in 2024, which is by no means guaranteed. And then some of the same entropy that has hit the Democrats this time around will start hitting Republicans. They will lose their momentum. Those who are in endangered seats will begin to worry about the midterms. And before you know it, we'll be back into divided government and the opportunity will have passed.
So MBD, no evasion. We need a straight out answer. If Donald Trump were running an election against Joe Biden, we're recording Wednesday. We usually record the first episode of the week on Tuesday, been a little delayed here. But next Tuesday, say election day is next Tuesday, Trump versus Biden, who wins?
Biden, but it'd be very close. It'd be closer than the last time. Just
even more stolen than last time.
Even more stolen than last time. I just don't think
why.
Okay, so right now, all in our minds is how poorly Biden's presidency is going and how it's performing. To be honest, I think voters saw what a poor campaign Biden had and didn't care. They wanted to get rid of Trump so badly that they came out in record numbers and voted for the guy in his basement with a drug addicted son that was being bribed by Ukraine. You know, I think we have not internalized how deep the antipathy was to Trump among so many voters. And it would still be there and it will return there. There's not so like...
Would Ron DeSantis running tomorrow, running next Tuesday, beat Biden?
He'd beat the hell out of Biden tomorrow.
Would any other Republican who'd be a possibility to win the nomination beat Biden?
Not any other Republican, no. Because if you just talked about, you know, raising taxes on the poor and dedicating your presidency to the Donbass, then I think you could still lose an election against Biden. But Ron DeSantis would beat the heck out of Biden, and a lot of Republicans would, but it still matters what you campaign on.
Zan, Trump, Biden, who wins?
I'm inclined to disagree with Michael. I think I think Trump would win very, very, very narrowly. And I think 2020 was much more, I mean, yes, obviously there's a very strong anti-Trump element in the vote for Biden. I don't think there was a huge kind of we love Joe Biden contingent out there, but I do think it was a lot more plausible when you went to the polls in November 2020 to think this was just going to be kind of like this neutral four-year normal Democrat type thing. And that's just not clear anymore. And I think, you know, people are very, very, very unhappy with how it's gone. And I suspect they're ready for a Republican, even if it would happen to be Trump.
Charlie?
Right now, I think Trump squeaks it. I think he wins Georgia, Arizona, and Nevada, and Wisconsin. And
did you have the map out?
Well, I was thinking while Michael and Alexandra were talking, and I wasn't quite sure what I thought, because I think it would be really close, and I think it would be unnecessarily close, and I hope Republicans don't do this to themselves. But I think if you look at where Biden is right now, it would be really difficult for Biden to win in Georgia, in Arizona, in Nevada, especially given the shift in Hispanic preferences, and probably in Wisconsin, maybe Pennsylvania. So I think Trump would prevail. I just hope, and I know everyone knows I think this, I'll just say it again for the record. I just hope that Republicans don't do that. I don't know if Ron DeSantis would beat the heck out of Biden. It's a divided country. Presidential elections are going to be close for a while. I do think that he would beat Biden more handily than Trump, and that there's just no need to take that risk.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with that. I think Trump would win. I think, by the way, Nevada this year could have one of the biggest blue to red swings up and down the ballot in the country. But I just think, to Zan's point, Biden was elected on false pretenses. I mean, this was not what people voted for. The results have been horrible. It would be a really close and unedifying election. But this time around, Trump would squeak it out. But why would the Republican Party want to take that risk? You know, that someone who follows this closely and has reasonable views, NBD thinks he would lose. I mean, why have a candidate where even that's a question? But that's something we'll be batting around the next 2.5 years. And at the moment, the party is not inclined to listen to this point. With that, let me very quickly pause, do an NR Plus plug. We have a subscription drive, our first ever site-wide subscription drive going on for NR Plus. Had some favorable results the last couple days. So this is your chance to get in, join the gang, dispense with the paywall, dispense with almost all the ads, plug deeper into our community by commenting on blog posts and articles. And this is important, Kevin Williamson's great newsletter that comes out on Tuesday, called very creatively, The Tuesday, is now hard paywalled. You can't get it unless you're a member of NR Plus. So discerning readers out there who love Kevin Williamson, this is your way to get more Kevin Williamson than you would otherwise to sign up for NR Plus. There's a 60% deal running right now, so the timing is propitious. So urge everyone to check it out and get on board if you're not already. With that, let's hit a few other things before we go. MBD, been a big week for you, a huge week for you. You got an email from Amy Chua. I have never gotten an email. If she's listening, Amy, please write.
Yeah. So I was at a conference a few years ago, Nationalism and Populism. It might have been 4 years ago.
Pretty much the only conferences. Well, Catholic conferences and Nationalism and Populism conferences. That's your bread and butter.
Yep. So I was at one. She was at the same conference, and this was before the summer of George Floyd, before it all, and we were just having the academic participants in the conference were having a very active conversation around the dinner table to close out the conference. And I remember I tried to explain to them that they didn't know how radical students were getting and how the direction things were going. And they asked me to explain where I thought it was going. And I said, oh, you know, I could see a world in 20 years where George Washington University changes its name. Like, this won't end with the Confederates. And almost every single academic at that table said, I'll take that bet. And that was a prediction from 4 years ago. 3 years, you know, 3 or 4 years later, we still got 16 years to go, and there are already op-eds appearing in the Washington Post saying that George Washington University should change its name to get away from the toxic legacy of George Washington. So Amy and I were just reminiscing about that, and it made me quite happy.
So we were batting this around before we started recording, and Charlie will take that bet still, right, Charlie?
I will. I don't think that's going to happen.
I'm starting to think that the kind of sting of this form of radicalism is kind of plunged too deep too early to, and people are going to reject it before we get to that point. So I'm coming around to my view that it won't happen either, but I think a lot of people are way more hesitant about taking that bet now than they were then.
So Zan, this is exciting. This is legitimately exciting. You're taking up watercoloring.
I am, yes. I just on a whim got a book out of the library that looked kind of interesting on how to watercolor. And I've never been a very artistic person. I obviously love writing, but, you know, painting, drawing, all that sort of thing is very much not a skill I've ever cultivated. But I just said to myself, look, this book makes it look at least doable, not simple, but at least, you know, I could try my hand at this. So I got some of the, you know, basic beginner supplies. They came in just this morning, and I am determined not to quit and not to let my perfectionism get in the way of trying.
So we were also talking about this a little bit before we started recording. My mom is a great painter. I have in my office where I'm recording now a couple of her paintings of my dad, my brother, and one of our family cats. And I had the exact same thought as you a long time ago. And I told my mom, she's like, that's the hardest. Richie, that's the hardest form of painting, even though it looks like it should be so easy. And it's just, you know, a couple, some colors and some water. So I would recommend taking up sketching if I were you. That's what I ended up doing. And you know, it takes time like everything, but if you spend some time on task, you can draw, you know, things that look like people. And especially I recommend charcoal, a kind of soft charcoal that you can easily manipulate. But the watercolors, it ends up being really, really tough. But I wish you luck. And we'll get updates as we go. Maybe you can head down to Fredericksburg and do a landscape in Fredericksburg. Charlie, what do you
mean? Maybe you could paint the squirrel. On the bottom, it's 2000 to 2002. Rest in peace. You can sign it. What have I been up to? I've been up to missing every exciting moment of last night's Yankees game. That's what I've been up to. I don't know how I managed to do this, but I turned on the game right from the first inning, watched it religiously, saw the Blue Jays go up 3. And then I left the room to go check on my kids who were in bed. And when I came back, it was 3-3. So I missed the Stanton 3-run homer. Then I carried on watching and saw that there was a contretemps on the field and someone had been thrown out. And so I had to catch up with that too. So I missed that. And then I managed to watch it for another couple of hours. I saw the Blue Jays score 2 more runs and I fell asleep about 1 minute before Aaron Judge hit a 3-run walk-off home run and won the game. So somehow I missed every single exciting moment in it for the Yankees and saw every one of the Blue Jays 5 runs. It was a real performance.
So when you say you watch a game, are you just sitting there with your beer in hand watching, or are you doing other stuff and have it in the background, or what constitutes watching?
I mean, sometimes I have it on in the background if I'm working, but in the evening, yeah, just sit and watch it.
Wow. Living the life. So speaking of conferences, National Review Institute had one half day conference down in Washington on Monday. This was not a populist or nationalist conference, so MBD was not invited. It was actually a hawkish foreign policy conference. All the more reason for MBD not to be invited. But it was a great event. Jerry Hendricks has written a lot for us about the Navy. Had a conversation with him. We had Congressman Mike Gallagher's thought a lot about defense and the kind of military we need. And Tom Cotton gave the keynote. And I hope you get a chance, actually, MBD, to take a look at some point. Really thoughtful. I think there's a lot of it you would have agreed with. The main theme of it is that foreign policy, you shouldn't have doctrines. It shouldn't be a doctrinaire question. And then he kind of drew a line, a thread throughout American history on a foreign policy, really aggressive in defense of our interests, running in his point of view from John Quincy Adams to Ronald Reagan. But anyway, great speech and a really nice event. With that, it's time in this podcast for editor's picks. MBD, what's your pick?
My pick is not a surprise this week. Again, it's Armand White. Armand writes on a music video, of all things. It's called Kendrick Lamar's Deepfake. And this is just one of those pieces only Armand could write. It's kind of a reflection comparing Kendrick Lamar's kind of buzzy new music video in which he transforms into O.J. Simpson and Kanye West and Jussie Smollett to Michael Jackson's once famous music video, Black or White. And anyway, it's just a fascinating little piece of cultural analysis.
Zan, what's your pick?
My pick is a piece from John McCormick from earlier this week about the Senate Democrats' effort to pass this radical abortion bill. They voted on a very similar bill earlier this year, but they're now bringing it back in light of the leaked majority opinion, or draft opinion rather. And there are a number of very radical aspects about this bill. You know, it would invalidate all state pro-life laws. But in particular, John did some reporting on the ground and has this piece about how the bill will actually make it impossible for states to protect babies from sex selective abortion. So if a family or a mother wants an abortion because her child is of the wrong sex or the not desired sex, it would be legal to have an abortion for those reasons, or rather states could not prohibit women from choosing abortion for such a heinous reason. So he has the details in a piece at NRO.
Charlie Cook, what's your pick?
Well, it was that. But I want to praise John McCormick more broadly, as I did Alexandra last time. Certainly not going to do that while Alexandra's on this podcast, for his coverage of this, because I will be honest, I didn't know most of what John has reported about this bill. I obviously would have opposed it. I don't think the federal government has the capacity to regulate abortion in either direction. And even if it did, I wouldn't want any sort of federal preemption of abortion, being a pro-lifer. But the details of this bill rendered the lie that it codifies Roe somewhat horrifying. And John hasn't just, as Alexandra said, done great reporting on this on NR. He's been all over this on Twitter, and he's been asking Democratic senators about it and put them in somewhat of an uncomfortable position. I think yesterday he asked Dick Durbin, who is, you know, hardly a conservative, about this bill. And Durbin sort of muttered something and said, I have the text, I'd have to look at it, which is not the language of someone who's confident in his position. And I think John's doing a great service by exposing that.
So I usually don't do this, but I'm going to pick an unsigned editorial, which is our remembrance of the great Midge Dector. What a tremendous intellectual force she was, utterly fearless and unsparing in her criticism of the idiocies of the left and the disasters she saw building from the radicalism of feminism, even in her prime in the 70s and the 80s. And she was just combined this really unsparing prose with the sweetest demeanor. She was such a wonderful person. And we had this editorial, MBD had a post, also Yuval Levin had a post. Classic Yuval just put his finger on what was so distinctive, important about her intellectual contribution. And Yuval clearly has read every single Midge Dector book and has something penetrating and acute to say about every single one. But what an accomplishment, what a life, what a lady. Most importantly, what a mother. Our hearts go out to our friends, John Podoritz, Norman Podoritz, Elliot Abrams, the entire family. Rest in peace, Midge Dector. With that, we have reached the end of this podcast. You've been listening to A National Review podcast. Any rebroadcast, retransmission, or account of this game without the express written permission of National Review Magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schitte, who makes it sound better than we deserve. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Zan. Thank you, MBD. Thanks to Allegiance Gold, Moink, and ExpressVPN. And thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the editors. We'll see you next time.